All right, everybody. Today, we're talking about bones. 31,000 years ago, a child had their leg amputated with stone tools and survived. This was a discovery that was made just a few years ago. And we're going to speak to the bioarchaeologist who studied those bones and can tell us a story of the person who they belong to. Dr. Melandri Vlock. Let's go.
That moment of near disaster.
And with difficulty kept my course.
Standing of chimpanzees in the wild.
It was for us the pleasure of discovering.
Melandri, am I pronouncing that correctly, Melandri?
As correctly as you probably could without speaking Afrikaans.
Oh, really? You're from South Africa?
I was born in South Africa, but I have an Australian accent because I moved to Australia when I was 6 years old. So I'm mostly Aussie, but the name still. Really stumps a bunch of Australians, I can tell you. I'm often Melandri over here.
Melandri.
Melandri.
Oh, Melandri, the bone expert. That's cool that you actually come from what part of South Africa?
I was born in Port Elizabeth, which just recently had a name change. It's now called Gqeberha, which was the sort of original name for that area. So I have to learn learn how to click, really.
Well, I mean, but it's a cradle of humankind, right? That whole region. So you originate from the origins. Well, not originate, but you're. You were born over in South Africa, right? But South Africa is the cradle of humankind, and your work goes back to the very beginnings of certain aspects of our humanity as well. And I just got to say, okay, so I read an article about a publication in Nature. By the way, congratulations. Mm. I mean, that's a huge deal.
Thank you.
A couple of years ago, maybe last year, that absolutely, it just knocked me to the ground, you know, on a very personal level, because the story was about an ancient amputee from 31,000 years ago who happened to have the exact same amputation that I have, right?
Wow.
You know, like the exact same cut where this person, you know, that you had been researching and, you know, had found out in the deep, deep, deep jungles of the mountainous tropical forest of Indonesia.
Right. Yeah.
In Borneo. And I'm like, what? But not only was it that, okay, you find this ancient skeleton, but it's 31,000 years ago. I mean, we're talking about the Stone Age, the Neolithic, right? We're like, what?
That's right. You know? Yeah.
I mean, a time before medicine, the way that we think of it, painkillers, surgical tools before metal, let alone anything else. So that story brought us eventually to you. We also have a couple, we're trying to reach out to Tim and some other folks, India and other folks on the team, but wow. And you, the more I read about you, and I'm going to stop talking, let you talk for yourself, of course. But you're like, your research is very unique. You're essentially, in my mind, like that TV show Bones, or, you know, an ancient forensic archaeologist trying to figure out how we did medicine in the very beginning. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up getting on this project?
Sure. Well, actually, that's how I started getting into biological archaeology, or bioarchaeology as we know, is that I was a teenager when Bones was on TV. And it shows how representation is really important, because I could see myself in Dr. Temperance Brennan. So I went to university thinking that I was going to be a forensic anthropologist. And then I became really interested in sort of being a bone detective for the ancient past, you know. The bones that we work on are far more degraded, so it's, to me, it was a greater challenge, and I just wanted to really get into that challenge as much as possible. And through my undergrad, I just realized just how much we don't know about our ancestors and the ancestors of everybody around the world. So as a bioarchaeologist, what I do is I work on ancient human bones And I try and understand from their bones by reading some markers or clues about their life, what their diet was like, what their health was like, what kinds of healthcare there was in the past, and also how they were died and how the community buried them with love and compassion.
Wow. You know, all things that are, I guess, as salient as they were 31,000 years ago, they are today. You know, right. We all face these moments where we need to be taken care of, or we need to take care of others, where we need to face our relationship to impermanence and everything else like that. But what really brought me to you was that one article that took us to Borneo. And this was not that long ago this was discovered, right? I mean, you know, I know that it's a big team effort, of course, and really kind of like a landmark thing, right? In terms of understanding the early origins of care and medicine and et cetera. But for me, I was just like, oh my gosh, when I actually looked at the photos of where you had found it and where that was, where this person had lived, it's remote. It's the kind of place I like to go. It's like remote, mountainous, tropical, hard to get to place, right? Can you just tell the story of how this was found from your perspective?
So this happened actually in January 2020, and obviously a very big event happened in January 2020. You know, the pandemic broke out. So Tim Maloney and India Elidilks Hall are these two Indiana Jones-like archaeologists who are willing to brave the wilderness, really. They get in there in the middle of the jungle. Every time they come back, Tim comes back with this giant beard. It's really as rough as you can imagine. They've got satellite phones because there's, you know, no contact with the outside world. And they were there actually to excavate evidence of the people who had created rock art. So there's evidence of rock art that's thousands of years old. We're talking 40,000, 50,000 years old in this part of the world. So they wanted to dig down in these caves where there is rock art to look for evidence of things like ochre, evidence of stone tools, for example, and boom, they found this skeleton, which they didn't expect. Now, this skeleton is 31,000 years old, which doesn't sound insane when people are hearing evidence of millions of year old fossils being found. But to put it in the context of tropical Southeast Asia, the tropics absolutely destroys bones. The microorganisms that live in the soil just degrade bone. So other skeletons that we find are like isolated bones at that age. This is a full skeleton. And I mean, I reconstructed everything was there except for this lower leg. Everything. It was remarkable. And of course, as they're exposing this skeleton, they do their weekly sort of phone call check to Max Aubert, who's the leader of the project. And he goes, you need to come back now. You need to come back now. There is a pandemic breaking out. Australia is going to close down. You need to return. So they had to quickly finish excavating the skeleton, ship the entire team back, and they basically made it back within a few hours, and then lockdown happened. Oh yeah, it's crazy. So then we shoot.
They got everything out in time.
So the skeletons, they left the skeleton in Indonesia, and they shipped themselves back. So then the bones were actually shipped to Queensland in the process. And that's actually was really fortunate for me, because I wouldn't have actually been brought onto this project if it wasn't for the fact that COVID happened, because I was still doing my PhD when they found the skeleton. So jump forward a year, I'd finished my PhD and I get a phone call from my old honours supervisor, Professor Mark Oxenham from ANU, and he goes, you're going to get a phone call. If I have heard that you have turned this opportunity down, I'm not going to like you anymore. And the next thing I do, I get this phone call from Tim being like, I'm going to send you some pictures. What do you think? And so he sent me these photos. They're still caked in dirt. They were upside down, so I could see there was some sort of disease, but I couldn't tell what was going on because it was completely still covered in dirt at the time. So I was like, look, I need to come to Queensland and look at this. And so we had to convince my university in the middle of COVID. There had just been sort of a bridge opened up between New Zealand and Australia at the time. We had to convince my university that I could go because we had like a travel lockdown in our university. Nobody was allowed to travel. So I went for 2 weeks. And I did this analysis, and within the first 2 days, I opened the first bones that I wanted to look at was the pathological bones, and I flipped them right way up, and I went, oh my God, because I could see it was an amputation. I could see already that it was completely healed, and I could see that it was a really, really nice clean cut. I literally...
Oh my gosh.
Opened up the lab door, ran down the hallway to Tim's office, and I went, it's an amputation. And he turns around to me and goes, the left foot was missing. And so they'd hid that from me. They'd actually hid that from me. They wanted to see what I could do. They had never worked with me before, and they kind of wanted me to have an independent sort of idea as to what's going on. But then the job was, I said, look, there's lots of ways that amputation can happen. Surgery is going to be the last resort because it's extremely unlikely. I said, there's situations with crocodiles, there's situations where, you know, you have types of amputations where people are born with their limbs separated because the sort of soft tissue in utero wraps around the limb, for example. Some people just don't grow a leg. Right. Like, it just happens sometimes. There's lots and lots of different reasons. Yeah.
Okay. So is this the image that you first got?
No. So they sent me an image that they had quickly taken on in the lab with a camera phone. And those images will never see the light of day.
Okay, but this is the excavation. So this is the skeleton.
This is the actual excavation, yeah. So you can see, anybody who's not even a specialist can see that the entire skeleton is there, every aspect of it. Now, you can't see the feet in this image, and that's because the foot bones they can be quite degraded when you're excavating, so they're still sort of uncovered at still covered at this point. But you can see, this is what we call a flexed burial, which is really sort of common during the sort of prior to agriculture in both mainland and island Southeast Asia. So what this tells us, this was a burial. So the person's lying on their back and their knees are tucked up in front of them. That's why you're seeing sort of like a bend in the leg bones, which are the big ones there. You can see that both the leg bones are sort of bent up. They're crouched up inwards.
So the person is the person clearly from this one image of where this person was found. It shows that the person was buried. So it wasn't like, you know, somebody fell from a crocodile bite and died. It was that they were placed, and there was a ritualistic approach to burying this person.
Correct.
Now, you said earlier that almost everything gets degraded. What was the perfect conditions that somehow allowed this particular skeleton to remain intact for 31,000 years in the tropics?
So the first thing is it's really high up in a cave. And so the cave environment, higher altitudes does protect a little bit from sort of the more humid situations in the tropics. But also in that photo, you can see some white specks in the soil. That is the grave fill. So the other thing is it's very rare for in the tropics for thousands of years where you can actually see a grave fill. So that's what they used to fill the grave back up, and they used a different soil for that. So it's a like lighter color, and it's limestone. So limestone combats a lot of the acidic situations that you see in tropical soil. So we think by accident they might have just kind of created the perfect burial environment for this individual to survive. And the fact that it's a deliberate burial is a really big thing because, as I was saying before, we often find isolated bones. And those isolated bones we also find in caves, but they're from sort of like washout in caves. So they've washed from somewhere else and then they've been excavated. So they're not evidence of burial, whereas this is very obviously a deliberate burial.
It's high up in a cave. There's rock art in the cave, which is why the team was doing excavations. And this rock art is among some of the oldest figurative art in the world, as I understand it.
Correct.
It's like animals, basically, right? And then they get these remains out of the ground, and then they're sent home because of the pandemic. Boom. And all of a sudden, is it when the bone's exposed to air, does it start to degrade further? Is it a race against time now to try to figure out what's going on, or what happens in the immediate aftermath as a detective of ancient bones?
We don't really know to what extent sort of changing the environment changes the bone, but we do the best that we can to sort of, one, protect the bone. So the bone is wrapped in aluminium foil, for example, and that just creates a sort of like structure cushioning that stops the bones from, when they're being moved, from really getting hit. The other thing is they can't go in when they're still coming out of the soil. They're wet because of the soil, so you have to dry them out, but you have to dry them out slowly. So one of the issues with the tropics is when you're excavating, the sun is so harsh, whether you're in a cave or not, that the thing that you're racing against is the bones getting baked. And when they bake, that's when they get all cracked and they basically shatter when they come out of the ground. So when we're doing excavations, for example, right on the seaside, that's one of the biggest things that we're fighting against. In a cave like this, it was a little bit easier for them to take their time, but obviously then with COVID, they had to get through it. Yeah, but was Tim and India are excellent archaeologists. They're just meticulous.
Did they find anything else near the body?
No.
It was just the bones.
Yeah. Just the bones. In the grave itself, they found a sort of like a cluster of red ochre right by the mouth of the person. So this red ochre, we think, has a ritual relationship to the rock art, because the rock art is, in some cases, what we call hand stenciling. So that's where you put ochre in your mouth, you mix it with saliva, and then you spit it out up against your hand. So it creates a negative imprint of your hand against the wall. So we think maybe this is what that purpose was, to leave that ochre around that person's mouth.
What? That's so wild, because I've seen this art before. Like I've seen the negative handprint recently in the jungles of Chiapas, Mexico. A totally different part of the world, a totally different time. We're talking about, this was post-classic Maya, so this is like a couple hundred years, maybe 500 years ago. You're saying 31,000 years ago, you could actually see the relationship to the action of the handprint that you're seeing on the wall, possibly the handprint on the wall, to the person that's holding that material near their head in their bone burial. That is wild.
Yeah. Well, like, we'll never be able to tell who it was that did the stenciling themselves. And so far, some of the rock art has been dated. There has to be certain processes that happen over the top of the rock art that you can date. Whereas other rock art, if they haven't had this natural process of basically, it's got carbon trapped in these rock... movement sort of down into almost like the same as stalactites and stalagmites that form in caves. But if they run sort of over the top of the rock art, you can actually take pieces of that and date the carbon inside of that. So we can only date the rock art where that's happened. We can't date the rock art where there hasn't been that kind of runoff over the top of the rock art. But the best that we can do is sort of interpret that that's sort of the ritual aspect. And it does make logical sense that that's why the ochre was around the mouth, but we'll never really know. And that's the most frustrating thing about archaeology, is that we still have so many missing pieces. It doesn't matter what we find.
Yeah, you know, but there is a big smoking gun in that burial, and that's the bones themselves. Bones don't lie, yes. Right?
No, bones do not lie.
So as the as I'm gonna pull out my little bone mascot here, which is, as you pointed out, a mermaid. This bone does lie because it's not actually, this is my Halloween mascot. But for you, as a bone expert, the ochre, the burial, all these other things, those are the last kind of ritualistic moments for this person. And then you look at the bones. And what can you tell from 31,000-year-old bones?
Look at the preservation, right? Can you believe that that's over 30,000 years old? The first thing I could tell when I laid it all out was everything really was there. It's all in pieces because that's just the reality. That's just the reality of working with stuff that's buried, is because the weight of the soil eventually just kind of breaks the bone. But that's where you specialize in learning how to refit the bone together. But the only thing that was missing was this lower left foot, and then part of the what we call the forelimb or the hind limb. So the bottom of our tibia, which is the larger lower leg bone, and our fibula, which is like the little pencil long bone that's next to it, that has been cut away. In a situation where you have a fracture, which is possible, it depends on the direction of the forces. It depends on a lot of things. But what is important with a fracture in the tropics is if you break your leg and you've just got a leg that's sitting and dangling around everywhere, you're going to get something like gangrene, and it's going to travel all the way up your leg. So when it comes to this individual, though, there was evidence of the lower leg having been completely healed, but we couldn't find any evidence of infection. We have had some orthopedic surgeons write a sort of a critical review of our paper, where they actually suggested that what they're seeing is infection, but this is an infection. This is actually just the typical thing that happens in a stump, which you won't see in modern amputations today, because the way that they do the surgeries make sure that they prevent sort of like these points of extra bone forming in a stump, because as you can imagine, that would be extremely painful to put in a prosthetic. So it's not something that orthopedic surgeons deal with in a way that paleopathologists deal with when we see amputations from sort of historical and prehistorical cases.
When I look at this image right now, the skeleton, and I can see where the amputation took place. I can't believe. I mean, it literally is the exact same residual limb length and everything. It's
wow.
It's as if, wow. I mean, it's the same person as me, right? That I'm looking at. I'm just looking 31,000 years into the past when they didn't have surgical blades, where they didn't have, pain medicine. I mean, this was painful. This was excruciating. This was the most profound experience in pain that I ever went through, and it lasted a long time. And I'm looking at this, and I'm like, how can you tell anything about the person, how old they were, what they went through, but also, did they live for a long time afterwards, and how the amputation was done? Because 31,000 years ago, in context, is literally the Stone Age. We're hunter-gatherers with lithic tools. That's it.
Yeah.
So you don't think of, you know, I couldn't comprehend going through something like this without the advances of modern medicine. What can you tell about how this went down?
And I think this is why we had that criticism from orthopedic surgeons, because it's just, for a lot of people, it's just unbelievable. For a lot of people don't understand archaeology, don't understand the innovation that humans had thousands of years ago and how they were masters of the environment, especially when we're raised in a very Western-centric sort of society where we think that our modern medicine is it, you know? And it's hard for people to believe that this could have happened, and not in Western civilization, but in the tropics in Borneo 31,000 years ago. They would have had to use stone tools. So they had bamboo implements, probably, not that we have any evidence of that. They would have had stone tools. They may have had shells, but really the only thing that's going to effectively cut through that bone is stone. So they would have had to use stone tools to cut through the bone. We have no idea what implements they used for the soft tissue. But they would have had to navigate the nerves, navigate the major arteries that you can bleed out from. And the other thing is, the size of this leg means that they were probably going through this amputation as a child. And when the leg was cut off, it stopped the growth of that leg. So we can see that they were probably under 10 years or so of age. The remodeling itself, the minimum age for that is 6 to 10 years. But when you actually look at the size of the bone, it was probably even longer. This person managed to live for 19 to 20 years of age. So they lived, you know, about a decade at least after this amputation in this really rocky karst environment that we're talking about, where people are climbing to get to places and things like that. This is an incredibly rugged environment. And when you look on the surface of the base of the amputation, you can see that this person was also using their limb. So because we have what's called... We have what's called evidence of resorption, where the bone is being resorbed, because them putting gravity on the stump itself is actually preventing blood flow to that bone area. And so it essentially starts to die and sort of get lost. So that's also why you're seeing on the tibia, that really sharp sort of point. So the larger bone... You see very sharp points around the rim of the bone, and that's that resorption. And you can see those little pores in that area. That's from general bone loss right on the surface of the bone itself. So they were using
this person's climbing on their stump. So they're actually using, and you're saying that this is over limestone peaks. They've turned the stump into a foot with all the nerve endings and everything. I tell you, when I put any pressure on the end of my residual limb, it's excruciating because of all the little nerve bundles and all the stuff that's down there. I mean, it's essentially the most sensitive wound that I've ever had, you know.
Correct.
And the idea of using it as a foot would be, I mean, that must have been really challenging. But what you said earlier was really quite remarkable, in that this is hard to comprehend from the ethnocentric point of view of only Western medicine can solve these challenges. Yep. But
correct,
in the tropics, what kinds of medicines did they have 31,000 years ago? Are we talking about plant medicines? Are we talking about how they had to stave off infection? They had to deal with shock. They had to deal with pain. They had to deal with all sorts of stuff. So any insights there into what's currently being used by indigenous communities for medicine that might have been used 31,000 years ago?
So that's actually what we're looking into now. We're trying to do a bit more of a further study into what's around today. One of the issues is that a lot of the sort of herbal medicines that are used are from cultivars. They're from sort of more modern introduced plants from various areas. So they're not sort of equal to the wild resources that would have been around about 30,000 years ago. But there are, I mean, if we're talking about any sort of medication, we talk about things like aspirin, these things originate from plants. And the tropics is exactly where you find this great diversity of plants that are used for all sorts of reasons. So when I was doing my honours, for example, I actually worked on a case of an individual who had broken their upper leg, so their femur, in two places, and it healed. And I did some ethnographic research. So I did some interviewing of the community that lives there today, who don't necessarily have the money to do to go to like traditional medicine practices or hospitals or anything like that. So I asked them about what they do instead, and they had lots of different types of plant varieties that they were using to, you know, heat up the wound, close the wound, keep the bacteria at bay, all those kind of things. And then when it comes to shock, the kind of community level care that's involved helps with keeping that person calm in terms of like the psychological shock. But in terms of the shock from blood loss, they would have had to tourniquet the limb. There's no way you wouldn't be able to have done this amputation without tourniqueting the limb in the process.
Well, you brought up a community. So this is a big one for me, you know, a big one. I think back to this story and immediately I see the person and I relate to the person. I'm like, oh God, this person had their limb amputated when they were a kid. No modern medicine. But they survived. And I can relate to the experience of being an amputee in the context of I've had a lot of people help take care of me. You know, like there was in the immediate aftermath, a period where I couldn't even get up to get a glass of water from one side of the room to the other. Right. I have a memory. Actually, there's an image that we could pull up of like the first moment I got out of the hospital and I went to this event where there was a bunch of amputees that were running a triathlon together and all my friends gathered around and they were supporting me. And I, you know, they made me believe in myself. They made me, you know, they gave me rides. They moved my bed downstairs so I didn't have to climb up the stairs. They fed me. My, you know, like all these people came together. And through a spirit of empathy, maybe, you know, or kindness. We're trying to find the right words here, right? Like, and I've seen this around the world, right? Like, it's not always that case, but we've seen it where people show up and stand up big for those who need it. Can we go to the image of the cave that was there? Pull up the image of this cave real quick. What I think about is, wow, in this hole in the earth, all these people had to come together and help this person when it didn't actually make sense logistically. You know, like they're hunter-gatherers, right? They're mobile. Mm-hmm. They're moving. They're like to take care of somebody who can't move for a decade will hold your troop back logically, right? So from an evolutionary standpoint, you'd think it was counterintuitive that something like kindness would emerge and care would emerge. Yet it's shown right here in this cave that the people around this person decided and made a calculated decision emotionally or logically or whatever that it was worth it to them to help this person continue to live. Do you have thoughts on that? Like the origins of this innately important part of our human spirit that sort of stands almost counterintuitive to our base need to survive as an individual versus collectively take care of each other?
There are so many theories in evolution about why we work together and we have care and we have compassion. There's this one quote that's constantly going viral, which was by Margaret Mead about a case where somebody had broken their leg and it was really bad, but they managed to survive. And she uses this as a case of what makes us human. Actually, that isn't what makes us human, because we actually know that primates do this. All sorts of animals do this. We're starting to realize that we're not really that different when it comes to deciding whether to try and incorporate somebody who's got something that may be perceived evolutionarily as being, you know, they're not fit. But I think there is so much complexity to the point of evolution. There's so many genes that are interacting that, and there is all sorts of trade-offs that we do. So trade-offs is the word that we use where you sacrifice something in order to improve something else. So we have all sorts of what we call life history trade-offs, where some animals, they have lots of babies, but they, you know, they don't live very long. For us, we live quite long, but we don't necessarily have a million children. Where sort of that group knowledge and care from an evolutionary perspective can increase your fitness if your cousins and your aunties, your nieces, or whatever it is, are still producing children. And so whether that person is considered to have be able to pass their genes down that may be related to you might not necessarily be as big of a thing as we used to think. And the way that we tend to calculate these things and in terms of evolutionary fitness is the direct relationship in terms of genes, how much of our genes are being passed down. And we have these really simple calculations. But biology in the world is not that simple. We can't break them down into calculations because there are so many levels. And then you're talking humans, and we don't just have what we call biological evolution. We also have cultural evolution. And cultural evolution is this idea that we respond and adapt to our environment to increase our survival through social change. And that has taken up a lot of, over a lot of the sort of natural biological processes of evolution. We tend to now adapt our environment today more than us adapting to our environment. You know, we change the world around us to fit us. That's a form of cultural evolution kind of taking over. So I don't think from an evolution, we always think about the selfish gene, that's the term that we talk about. But in order to pass down your genes successfully, whether it is your own genes or whether it's through your collective community, that care and compassion might be something that's really important. Whether it is somebody who's going to pass down their genes, but there needs to be this level of trust, I guess, that next time round, it's going to be you too, you know, that kind of situation. Yeah. So it is so much more complex.
I mean, you said it so well, but the cultural evolution here is basically that they've learned somehow that they're stronger together than apart, and that it's worth it to take care of each other because you might need it yourself one day. But there's also, there's just a very human story here. Going back to this person, how can you tell how long when they had the amputation, how long they lived afterwards? Can you tell if it was, you know, was a person from the structure of their bones, were they actually mobile beyond just sort of crawling around a little bit? Did they grow up to be, you know, part of the hunting team? Like I think often to myself as like, okay, I have this ability to have my prosthetic allow me to climb anything, to swim anywhere, to do whatever, right? But is there a part of this person's story that decayed that we might not be seeing in the barrel? Did they come up with some really cool prosthetic 31,000 years ago that just disappeared with time?
I mean, it's possible, but the evidence from the bone itself also suggests that maybe they were just putting it directly onto the limb. And I think that's because it is just the sort of lower leg and the foot that's amputated. Their overall body suggests that they weren't extremely mobile, like they weren't a strong individual in terms of they weren't using their upper body horrendously in sort of compensation for their lower limb. So what that tells us is that community accommodated quite significantly for this person not being able to be so mobile anymore. And the tropics are beneficial in this sense, and maybe this story is the reason why it's the tropics is because the tropics has really high resource returns. You know, there's lots of plants and animals in tropical environments that mean that you don't need to be so mobile. You know, you still have to move around because when you deplete the resources in your area, you know, you have to move on, but maybe not to an extent that you might see in let's say, the hunter-gatherers of Europe that had to really traverse kind of long sort of kilometers, really, to hunt for food.
Yeah, but limestone's sharp. It's vertical. Cave sounds like it was high up. It's a hard environment to be in. And the fact that this person was cared for in that environment, is one thing. But the fact that that this happened at a time when, the sort of medical, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, yes, okay, I don't want to be ethnocentric and say, yes, only Western medicine makes sense here. But this is an advanced surgery. And then an advanced aftercare, right? Like, it's like, it takes a while. So what, if you were in your mind, having looked at these bones, can you put yourself in a first person perspective and just tell us the story of how this, so this person, maybe they were brought out into the light so that you could see what you were cutting, what had to happen that was... not super gruesome, but kind of, just direct. How did this go down in your mind, being the forensic scientist that studied exactly what happened to the bones?
That's kind of the gift and the curse to being a bioarchaeologist, is I can visualize what's happening. I can see the story in my mind. Yeah. So from my opinion, my opinion. Yeah. The first question is, why did the amputation happen in the first place? And we can't really confirm it, but there is other evidence on the bone, like their neck was broken and healed as well, possibly just as long as the amputation. So maybe there was a rock fall, maybe some sort of reason that caused them to land on the back of their neck. Their foot was crushed or something. There was some sort of reason that happened that meant that foot needed to be amputated. People don't go amputating for no reason. There is punishment amputations, but then why is this person buried and looked after and cared for so well? So the idea of that being a punishment amputation, and punishment amputations also more commonly are like fingers and arms, not legs.
But the neck was broken.
And when
also,
their so legs. Could upper neck. So the second vertebrae down. I don't think they were paralyzed because they were moving around. We've got evidence that they were standing up and moving around and using their limbs. Yeah. And then the area around the spinal cord seems to be still fine and intact. So there was the crack in the vertebrae, but not to such a significant that they were, because at that point they would have been quadriplegic or partially quadriplegic, which is where, like, intermittently quadriplegic, which there is another individual from 4,000 years ago in northern Vietnam that we have evidence of quadriplegia, and their bones look entirely different. I've had the privilege of actually seeing those bones in person, and they look very different to our individual with the amputation case. So they were walking around. So they survived some sort of traumatic event that required them to have the foot amputated. And it would have had to have happened quickly. This is not a situation where whoever's around is giving something the old stab and hoping it's working. This is somebody who knew what they were doing. They probably learnt about sort of the anatomy by butchering bones. But there would have been knowledge passed down, across generations.
So this has happened before?
Well, I don't know whether an amputation has happened before, but possibly some sort of surgical intervention may have happened before in order for them to do this. Yeah. How many steps are involved to get to this level of success. They're not just taking a saw to someone's foot. These are stone tools. And stone tools don't just cut in one strike. You're going to have to cut... strike multiple times. And it does seem to be on the surface of the bone, there's different directions involved, which we published in a second.
You can see the cuts. You can actually...
You can see, you can see different angles to the bone itself, which also further suggests that it's not just like a simple fracture. There's like different directions to it. So they were probably striking across different directions. So we published that actually in response to these orthopedic surgeons when they replied to our paper. So there is something incredibly specialized here, which to me means there is a lot of learning and sharing of knowledge, very specialized knowledge. So there is a pre-existing medical system here, is how I see it. I can't really see how somebody, if you think about the odds, you know, they gave it a stab to cut the leg off, and then they gave it a stab to let the leg heal without any infection, and then they gave it a stab to you know, allow this person to... There's so many factors involved in this surgery and aftercare that have been put in place that though I at least some of them would have pre-existed. I think it's just evidence of a much larger medical system that was pre-existing in this really rugged environment where injuries was probably really common in this area. You know, people are falling off cliffs and stuff like that. It happens when you're living in this kind of environment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but not only, yeah, it happens, but to pull it off, for the infection not to happen, and then to care for the person afterwards, it's just so powerful in a relationship to, you know, just what motivates us.
You've also to innovate. You've also got to remember this was a child. Can you imagine having to hold that child down, having to do this surgery? I think it would have been a traumatic experience for everybody involved, not just the child. Like, I can't imagine. I see the screams that this child would have had. Maybe they knocked the child out with something or not. Like, we just don't know those aspects, and we'll never know those aspects. So, like I said, whatever it was something that happened very quickly.
Whatever happened in that cave and whatever happened afterwards must have been also quite beautiful, right? I mean, the amount of love and attention that this person received, and then to be buried in the way that they were later on, there was, it's just this deep, very early expression of human care and kindness. And, you know, yes, pain is brutal, but pain is something that, you know, we don't really remember, I guess. Like you sort of have the pain and you have it and you experience it and you remember the concept of it, but you don't really remember the feeling of it. I feel like when I look at this person's amputation, I shouldn't say that, because I can't comprehend the pain that they went through. I don't know that level of pain. But yes, one part of this is the trauma. The other part of this is the story of kindness and the story of community that's right there in front of us. And that's what struck me when I saw this 2 years ago. I would really love to come to this part of Borneo and be in that cave. I heard the rock art is actually in the walls of that cave. And it feels like the story that we're describing now of that triumph, of that community, of that care, of that kindness, and also the screams of pain and all those other things, they're written on the walls of that cave. You know, maybe, like you said, you can't quite date it exactly with precision, but it seems like a pretty logical connection if the person is buried with the ink of the walls right next to their head. You know,
I think it's the thing that makes the most sense, and that's the best that we can do in archaeology. And we've got to remember that these people are human as well, and we do, to an extent, all think the same. You know, we do all have this kind of desire to leave a mark of ourselves. You know, today it's in the form of graffiti. We like to talk about graffiti as being modern day rock art, because it's what it is we want to leave an impression of ourselves somewhere. And when we bury someone, it's because we care about them and we love them and we respected the life that they had. So for me, every time I'm excavating or working with bones, I take that very seriously, because someone laid them there to rest, and I need to do my job properly because I am, so I'm digging them back up again, and that's a really, really big thing for me.
Well, there's a huge poetry in this, you know, that the mark that this person left is not only in the ink in their hand and the messages on potentially on the walls, hypothetically, but it's the mark of the community that's shown in the scars of their bones. I guess the last question I have for you is, and maybe this isn't even appropriate, but did you guys give this bone and this skeleton a name, this individual? Was there an assigned thing? Like, I don't know, just, you know, I think they had
a name sort of on excavation, but I personally don't tend to give names to skeletons because it sticks. And to me, that person's community had already given them a name. So I'm kind of removing the name that they had by giving them a new one.
I understand
that names are really good for science communication because it sticks with people. But me as the bioarchaeologist, I also feel very sort of like responsible for their story of who they were and responsible for the community that looked after them. So for me, from an ethical perspective, I choose not to give them a name because they would have already had one. Yeah.
Yeah. And what you do find, it maybe isn't their name or something as specific as that, but it is their story. And their story is, this person's story is one that I think we still grapple with today. To care for others or fend for ourselves and how that all plays out. But in this case, they cared. And wow, like how I've experienced care in my life made this one really, like it just knocked me to the ground.
I'm really glad that we actually had an opportunity to talk about community because I feel when we were doing a lot of press for this case, you know, people were really focused on the surgery and the story of the person, who they were as an individual, kind of started to take in people's minds and in the public's mind kind of a back step. And it was the surgery or the bone that the surgery happened to became sort of like the main thing that people were focused on. And we run into a threat of treating someone like a specimen when we do that, but they're not specimens, they were people. And so I really love the fact that you can relate to that community aspect and because to me, that's the most important aspect of this story.
Yeah, me too. I'm gonna pull up one last little anecdote, and that's from, I took a trip to India right around the same time that this bone was being discovered, at the beginning of the pandemic. And with a team of students, I had a PhD student named Isaac Cabrera, who was leading this effort to try to create 3D scans using photogrammetry of people's limbs for 3D printing prosthetics. And we went and visited this place called Jaipur Foot, which is one of the largest nonprofits for people with disabilities in the world. I think it's something like 30 years or 40 years, they've given away over 500,000 free prosthetics just to anybody who can show up in Jaipur to this clinic. I sat next to this woman who had come by, you know, bus and train and everything like that to receive a prosthetic. And I just, you know, and my students, we'll show the students real quick also. The students with the blue shirt on, these guys had, they were, these are my engineering students from UCSD that were with Project Limitless trying to figure out how they could distribute this, you know, this care with mobile tools and things like this. And it was really powerful. It was really powerful. But when we actually met the team of prosthetists that were volunteering, there was this one moment where a lot of them were amputees themselves, where they had to put the cast. So they put the cast on and then they take the cast off and they're all sitting on a shelf waiting to get molded for the prosthetic. And this one cast had everybody writes the prosthetist's name on each cast so they know which one's going to which bin and which whatever. And this guy who is the prosthetist for this woman, his name that he had given himself in English was Love, you know? And I mean, it's just so poetic. I see him holding this cast. And it just says Love. And the guy is just working tirelessly with the rest of the team to provide free help to people who are otherwise marginalized. And the, you know, I just think back to that cave 31,000 years ago, and the emergency that happened, the moment, the pain, the suffering, but then the immense show of love that you see in the story, you know, you see between the lines, you see in the bones. And that gives me this really fuzzy, warm feeling about the power of human kindness, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I hope this isn't the, I know we're going to wrap here pretty soon. We've been at our hour mark, but I just want to say thank you for what you created and put out there into the world. The story was deeply personal to me when I read it. I'm really pretty blown away by your story that started with the TV show Bones, because we just talked about that. Bear and I were like, hey, what should we bring up? Bones. And then all of a sudden, there you go. You're talking about Bones. maybe one day we would be able to, I hope to get out to that cave and see those. I just want to see that handprint.
I know. Yeah.
You know, and just to relate to the person that was the one without a name, but with a big story. Melandri, thank you so much. And is there anything else you want to say before we go?
Just thank you for sharing your story, because it really kind of puts everything even more into perspective for people as to what a big deal this is for people to come together and to really share their heart and their soul with somebody who is in need at a time when they need it most. And that's what makes us human. And so I loved sharing with you that you and I see the same sort of beauty in this story. And it goes beyond just bones, you know. I start with bones, but what I try and piece back together is the humanity. And I think we need a lot of humanity right now in this world. So for me, I feel like my work is quite important in just reminding people of all of that.
It's a mic drop right there. Melandri. Okay, well, I'll see you, I hope, in Indo or Aussie or
I'd
anywhere over there.
I'd love that. Yeah.
yeah. We're gonna come out with our little crew and we're gonna go see that handprint eventually.
That'd be so good. Yeah.
To able to take us. But thank you so much.
It's an entire cave complex, actually. So it's like multiple rock arts across an entire cave complex. So it's quite big. They excavate that entire complex. This cave is just the start to the entire project. Yeah. It's not just one cave.
Oh, my. Oh. And it was just discovered. Okay. All right. Now I'm Well, let's clear the deck. We're going to Indo. We know where we're going. It's also got great surf, too. So perfect for us.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that.
yeah. Indonesia. Well, great. If it's okay with you, we're going to end the podcast now, but thank you so much. But then if you can stick on for a little bit, just for a few minutes afterwards, we'd love to chat about how to make that actual expedition happen. Melandri, the bone forensic scientist that revealed the earliest story of kindness. This is my mascot for you. I don't know why. I don't know why it's a mermaid or merman, but it is.
Well, if I find one of those, that's my next nature paper. So
thank you.